Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM 89.5 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, Memorial Day is almost upon us, and we here at your Weekly Constitutional have enormous admiration for our military service men and women. We note that they take an oath that's extremely important, that includes a promise, an affirmation, or a sworn statement that the serviceman or woman will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, lots of people take oaths and lots of people make promises, but our service people back that oath up with their very lives, and often their duties, whether during peacetime or wartime, take them into dangerous situations, put them directly in harm's way. And so today, as a salute to our brave servicemen and servicewomen, we're bringing you a story that I came upon entirely unexpectedly when I was interviewing an unexpected interviewee. A friend of mine suggested that I talk to a fellow named Doug Beckstead. You don't call him Doug, though. You call him by his nickname, Crash. Crash Beckstead is a civilian employee of the United States Air Force, and Crash has a fascinating job. Crash is the fellow who, if a plane crash, a plane wreck emerges from one of those glaciers up in Alaska, or is discovered on some remote mountain peak, Crash is the guy that the Air Force calls to figure out, where did this wreck come from? What plane could this have been? Who was on the plane? What should we do with what we find? Well, Crash has not one but two fascinating tales to tell us. And the first of those, well, before we get to the story, let's let Crash explain about what he does and why he has the nickname he does.
Well, I'm a historian for the Air Force. I work for Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson up in Anchorage, Alaska.
Now, for the geographically challenged, what part of Alaska is Elmendorf Richardson then?
That's what we call South Central Alaska. It's on basically the southern coast. You've got the panhandle that comes up along Canada, mm-hmm. then the bulk of Alaska, and then the tail that goes out to the Aleutians. So we're at the southern end of the main part.
Is that near Fairbanks?
It's about 300 miles south of Fairbanks.
Well, Crash, you've told me you're not a pilot, and you told me you're not in the military, so now I have to ask the obvious question, what do you do at the base? You said you're a historian, right?
The sexy way of doing this is saying I gather information and write reports.
Uh-huh.
I'm a historian.
Right.
At my base, we have got the 11th Air Force, mm-hmm. which is our overall, we call it a NAF, a numbered Air Force. Then we have the 3rd Wing, which is our operational wing, 673rd Air Base Wing, which is the combination of Army and Air Force. They run the base. And then we've got National Guard units, we've got reserve units. I think we have something like 75 tenant units breaking down all of them on the base. And my job is to write the annual histories of the 11th Air Force and the Alaska NORAD region. You've got NORAD that covers the lower 48 in Canada, and then we have the Alaska NORAD region out there, and we're the ones that we're the first line of defense with anything coming over from the old Soviet Union, from Russia right. today.
Now, let's a couple of acronyms here: NORAD, North American Air Defense Command.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And yes, since you're up in Alaska and you're close to the Arctic Circle, we used to call that the DEW line, right? Distant Early Warning Line. Is that what they still call it?
That was a series of radar installations that wrapped around Alaska and went all the way across Canada over to Greenland.
Right, and that was to detect incoming missiles or airplanes
that
came across. Now, is that still what it's called, or is that old terminology now?
Most of the DEW line is gone now. Okay. We still have some radar sites. They're minimally manned radar sites. They're pretty much automated all the time.
Right.
And we go out there and do maintenance work on them. And they have like a cycle they go through to do
right.
that. And everything is now transmitted up via satellite and then back down to Elmendorf or down to NORAD at Cheyenne Mountain. and then it gets sorted out from that point.
Well, it's a scary mission, of course, but a very important one, and I guess even though there is no longer a Soviet Union, there are still entities on that side of the world that have an awful lot of intercontinental ballistic missiles and other nasty things. So part of your job is to watch out for those things, right?
My job is to write the history of
it. Write the history of that, okay. So,
there are
okay,
other people that are much more versed at it and much better at their jobs than me.
But there are a lot of people doing these things. I mean, they're flying the F-22s, they're flying the C-17s, they're manning the what remains of the dew line, they're watching out for bad things happening, and then they all file reports, they all generate paperwork, and then you're the guy that comes and keeps track of it all.
Well, we collect everything as much as we can, and today we're lucky most of it's in digital form. So we don't have huge piles of paper and things, just lots of digital files. And then it's our job to sort that out and decide what are the main things that are going on. What kind of, you know, if we had any kind of major humanitarian missions that we've run, like in the Pacific, like, you know, down in Indonesia with a tsunami or something, or well, Fukushima. The nuclear reactors in Japan, we had a lot of stuff going over there, and we were ready to take people from there coming over here to evacuate. Then major exercises that we run, we have one called Northern Edge, which involves Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines. Just a massive exercise to be able to train with all the pieces to get working together. So you fight the way you train. And if you never work with the Navy, then how do you know what their capabilities are? How do they know what our capabilities are? If you don't train with the Army, you know, same thing.
Right.
And now we're also interconnected.
Well, there's a concept. Very important one. Okay, so you write the histories of all these things, and I'm sure that a lot of what goes on is classified. And do you have a security classification? And
yes,
you then have to be careful not to divulge anything in your histories that shouldn't be divulged.
No, I have a security clearance,
right.
And my histories are all classified.
Oh, they are. So your end product.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Never
my end product. You will see.
That's just terrible, isn't it? You write these histories, and I'm sure a lot of it's really interesting stuff, and then somebody comes and takes it all away, and nobody gets to read it.
Well, that's yeah.
I guess one day maybe it'll see the light of day, right? And we'll all get to see how brilliant you are.
Well. When we do it, the physical makeup of them, every paragraph has a classification on it. Most of our histories are unclassified. But when we start dealing with classified information, the overall document has to be classified to the highest level of any information that's in it. Now, if, for example, I wrote a big study on the volcanoes in Alaska on the western side of Cook Inlet and their impact on the Air Force over in the Anchorage Bowl. And goes back 200 years because we've got a lot of very active volcanoes up there, and we occasionally do have them decide to burp and throws a lot of ash in the air. And what do you do with it? Or how's it going to impact our operation and our mission? And because I had one operational order in it that was classified as for official use only, the entire document is classified as for official use only. But I can take that one document out and any references to that document, and then it becomes an unclassified document. So we can pull things out of them. If you wrote to me and said, you know, I was up there 5 years ago, we did, you know, a certain exercise or a certain mission, and this is an example of things I've actually had happen, and you're looking for information about it because you're writing your memoirs now. And I can go back into our histories and find, oh, yeah, that's the mission. Your name may not be associated with it, but I can get you the background of the mission and stuff. As long as it's not classified, I can release it to you.
I see. Okay. Well, the first draft of military history then, and at some point some military historian might come back 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now and put it all together into a book and write about what was happening up in Alaska in the early 2000s.
Sometimes we actually even have members of Congress, Secretary of Defense, Chair or the Joint Chiefs will call us and say, we're looking for information on this. And, well, actually I've never received a phone call from the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, but I did get a phone call one day from a Lieutenant General, that's a 3-star general, who said, I'm General Mosley's executive officer. He needs to know X, Y, and Z for a talk this evening. Can you help me?
Right.
And we prioritize requests.
I imagine that went to the top of the list.
Chief of Staff calls, you jump.
Yeah, I imagine so.
And got the information form, sent it off to him, and they immediately put it in Yeah, it could be as simple as a speech,
right.
Or it could be something much bigger. My former boss, when he was deployed, got a phone call from the Secretary of Defense's office, and they wanted to know how many bombs had been dropped in Iraq from the beginning until that point. They worked for almost 36 hours to pull just that information together. The following day, they were sitting in a mess hall, and they had Secretary of Defense on CNN, and he said, from the beginning, we have dropped X number of bombs, and Jim and his partner were like, that's our information.
Yeah, well, I saw it on
So
TV.
You see it immediate sometimes.
Right.
So there's the audience that we're writing for is very, very wide. And to me, one of the nice things is that we are, as you said, doing the first cut on this stuff. I look at myself as like the chroniclers that went with the Romans and the Greeks and the Spartans. You know, they're out there, they're writing down all the particulars of what was going on. And now, 2,000 years later, we're going back to take that stuff and going through it and trying to figure out what they did.
You're a modern-day Tacitus.
Yeah.
Your nickname is Crash, and apparently investigating crashes is, or at least researching the history of them, is part of your job. What happened with that?
Well, I've had a number of people ask me about my nickname since I
right.
got it. That, you know, you're in the Air Force. Do you really want to be known as Crash?
Right.
And so I tell them, I love it. Because what I'm doing is dealing with historic crashes. Last year we had one that surfaced out of a glacier. There are 52 men on board that plane.
Wow.
And for 60 years, they've been up on this glacier.
Well, tell the story from the beginning. So 60 years ago, a plane disappears.
Okay, 60 years ago, it was a C-124 flying from McChord Air Force Base in Washington.
That's a transport plane.
It's a transport plane. It was the largest transport in the inventory of the Air Force.
Okay, and it's an old propeller driven.
It's old propeller driven. It's called Old Shaky because mm-hmm. the whole plane just rattled apparently.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually got two decks in it.
Mm-hmm.
The upper deck is on hinges and can fold up against the top to put tall things in it. They can put tanks and heavy equipment in there without taking the turret off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Taller equipment without disassembling it. So it was a very good airplane. In November 22nd of 1952, they were flying up to Elmendorf, and all of a sudden they just disappeared. It took a week before before any evidence of a crash was located, and there were planes searching everywhere for it after it went down. They knew that where the last point they'd radioed in from was, and so they just began to search out from there. And the plane hit the wall of the mountain, the very, very peak of the mountain. If they had been 100 feet higher or 100 feet to the left, they would have gone over the saddle and missed it, or over the top and missed it.
Man.
It was just one of those things. It's like the bug that hits the antenna of your car.
Oh, man.
You know, just that. It just right there.
Right.
It hit the wall and just disintegrated. There's no explosion, no post-crash fire or anything. But because of the impact, the aluminum of the aircraft just shredded. It fell down the wall, landed on the glacier, and then there was an avalanche that came down of snow and rock that buried the airplane. Over the next week, there's more snowfall because it's up in a high ridge area between Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet, so they get tons and tons of snow up there every year. It's up in an ice field, which is at the head of glaciers. The ice field is the part that doesn't move, then the glacier flows down from that, down to tidewater. And the plane was just completely buried. There was a search and rescue team that got in there 10 days later, and they could find no evidence of it at that point. And then last June, we had an Air National Guard, or an Army National Guard helicopter team was out doing just the training mission up in that area. And they looked down and they said, that doesn't look right. That looks like a big old landing gear. And they saw some yellow things, and they said, that shouldn't be out here. So they landed, and they realized the gear, the wheel they saw was a piece of landing gear from a very large airplane. The yellow stuff was pieces of life rafts. So what are they doing up there? And so it was obviously debris from some sort of a crash. They came back in to get some more fuel and checked with our rescue coordination center, and they identified three different aircraft that had crashed in that area as far back as we had records for.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was a C-124. And because of the size of the wheel and all, they figured that's probably the plane that it is. That was on a Sunday afternoon. Monday morning, I got to work, and I found an email from the base commander saying, I want my historian involved in this thing. We're having a meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning. I went into high gear and started pulling what records I had, made some requests for the actual accident investigation file, trying to pull as much together as we could, because we had to know what aircraft is it, what kind is it, what's on the aircraft, what was on the aircraft, what might still be up there that could pose a danger to anybody who goes up there as part of any sort of recovery effort.
And yeah, I guess in the worst case, it could have been a plane that was carrying nuclear weapons or chemicals that are dangerous.
Exactly.
Or just live ammunition.
Exactly.
That could be dangerous. Yeah, that'd be important.
So I had to find manifests of everything that was on it. One thing that was interesting was the amount of mail. There were like 4 tons of mail on this airplane. That was how the mail got to Alaska, was on big transports like that. And something I like to wonder is, what happened to all of that? All those letters that were coming up.
There are probably people still alive who were the recipients of those or related to them.
Yeah.
Who might very well want those letters, because as much as we find this just historically interesting, we have to remember, I think you said there were 52 soldiers or airmen or Marines on that plane, right?
There were people. There were 52 people on board that plane, the crew and the passengers.
Yeah.
And there's one woman from Florida who has been very active in trying to find this aircraft because her grandfather was on it.
Right.
And her family never got closure with this. And her grandmother had passed away a little while ago.
Yeah,
these 52 guys just disappeared.
Just disappeared. So they must have been really intrigued when this surfaced, this plane did.
Well, it suddenly popped up, and immediately they went into hyperspeed on, you know, is it this plane? What's going to happen with it? And then you have to look at the fact that we had 52 people on it. So now you've got these people who are related to the folks who are on the plane asking questions, and we've got human remains up on the glacier. So now what do we do with
those? Of course, they would be preserved.
Yeah.
They've been in snow and ice for 60 years. So I imagine some of it was actually pretty well preserved, right?
I was amazed at some of that I've seen pictures of and stuff. So the initial thought was, let's get up there and gather all these folks up and get them back home. And because I've worked a similar crash before, I knew that we couldn't do that. You know, we could, but that's not the right way to do it. There's a unit called the Joint POW MIA County Command out of Hawaii at Hickam Air Force Base. They're the ones that go, mainly you hear about them going over to Vietnam and the South Pacific.
Right.
They do the excavations of old crash sites and things, and then bring the remains back and repatriate them, get them back to their families. So I immediately said, no, we need to get JPAC involved with this. And they know the protocols, they've got the training, they know how to handle the stuff, the remains and everything. They'll do it in a very dignified manner, but they're the ones, you know, as we said earlier, different groups have got different specialties as to what they do, and that's what these guys do.
So you called the guys from Hickam?
They set up a team. They came up the next day. And
the next day, all the way from Hawaii to Alaska?
Yeah.
That's a long way.
It is, and, well, initially it was, okay, we're going to come up, we're going to see what we've got. We're going to assess it, and then we'll plan where we go. Because this whole thing is just in the beginning stages of it. We really didn't know what's it going to involve, how many people is it going to take. Gee, do our people have the training to be out on an active glacier? Oh, by the way, this is about 200 meters from the toe of the glacier, the bottom edge of it. So pieces are falling off of it constantly. It's moving, a lot of crevasses. It's a very, very dangerous area to work in. So you can't just go running out there, and because you're going to have more casualties or more injuries, if nothing else, than you want. So we had to start back up and start planning. JPAC went out, they assessed everything, and they gathered up as many human remains as were on the surface, and they thought that they probably got a good portion of what we were going to find. Anything else that was there was frozen into the glacier. We don't know how thick this glacier is. I've heard estimates of 500 to 1,000 feet. So that's a big chunk of ice. You can't go out there and just start melting it down with blowtorches to see what's down inside of it. So they gathered all that stuff up. Then our commander decided we need to go up there and gather the debris up. We don't want it to just go and dump into the lake down at the bottom and have all these pieces of fabric and lifeboats and stuff floating around the lake. So we then, over the next month, planned out, you know, how many people it's going to take, what kind of resources will it take, what kind of aerial support will it take, you know, what's the Army going to be able to do for us, equipment-wise, helicopter-wise. And then they pulled off the cleanup, and that was a rather interesting operation. They would fly out in the morning and take big Tupperware totes, put all the pieces into it, and I mean, literally, we're talking, this was shredded metal. So very few large pieces of anything. And then they would take those totes, put them into a bigger box, and then helicopter them back to base that evening when they bring the team back in. And the next day they would start over again. And it took about 2 weeks.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with military historian Crash Beckstead for this Memorial Day episode of your weekly Constitutional, where we're saluting our men and women in uniform. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more with Crash Beckstead. Stay tuned. Well, it's time once again for our constitutional quiz, and with me, as always, is Kelly Carmichael, our quiz lady.
Hello, Stuart. How are you?
I am doing so well. It's hard for me to describe it, so I'll skip it. Do we have a contestant?
Yes.
And who are you, sir?
My name is Matt.
And where are you from, Matt?
I am from Belfry, Kentucky.
Okay, I'll make the obvious joke. Do you have any bats?
No, sir, there's no bats in my belfry.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because we've got a hard quiz question for you. Don't we, Kelly?
We do. We always have challenging questions.
Well, then let's give it to Matt.
All right. Here we go, Matt. The best description for a federal system of government is A, one government has all the power. B, the people do not have any power. C, power is divided between national and state governments. Or D, power is divided among the states.
Those are some interesting choices. Could you repeat the question once more, please, Kelly,
sure,
so I can write this down?
Of course. The best description for a federal system of government is A, one government has all the power. B, the people do not have any power. C, power is divided between national and state governments. Or D, power is divided among the states.
Okay, so a definition of a federal-style government. Matt, we read it to you twice now. Do you have any thoughts?
I'm between C or D, but we can go through all of them if you want to.
Well, please, let's start at the beginning then. What about A? You didn't like that?
No, I don't think A, because I don't think a federal government, that all the powers are reserved to the government. You know, and the United States, it's said that, you know, most of the power is reserved to the people.
Oh, well, hold on just a second before we're still on A. So you're one of these states' rights people, are you?
I'm kind of a mixture of both.
Okay. So not the federal government doesn't have all the power, nor do the state governments. Okay, so it's not just one government. What about B then?
I don't think the people have all of the power, but which I mean.
Well, B said that there was no power for the people, right?
I don't think.
I feel like I have all the power when I'm doing these quizzes.
I don't think that. Yeah, I don't think the people have no power, because, you know, we vote for our presidents and our legislators.
Okay, so B's not it either. And what about C then?
C sounds kind of good. I like that one.
A division between national and state governments defines what a federal government is.
C sounds good, but then you get to D.
Well, what about D then? Well, D was, what was that again, Kelly?
Powers divided among the states.
Power divided among the states.
See, I would say D, but I know there's power divided among the states, but also our federal government has powers too, so that's why I don't think D is it.
Okay, so you're going to knock out D, and that leaves you with C, that you've got a federal system with both national and state governments. Is that your final answer?
That's my final answer.
He sounds pretty confident, Kelly.
C is the answer. Powers divided between national and state governments.
Tremendous. That's exactly right, Matt. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
You're going to get a T-shirt.
All right.
Yeah, and in fact, that's an extremely important point. Federal system literally does describe a situation where in any geographic place, no matter where you stand in the United States, there are at least two governments that have some authority over you, and that's the government of the state in which you stand and the government, the national government. So we sometimes call it the federal government, which is a bit misleading. It's really a national government and a state government, and then together the national and state government system is a federal system. And so that's exactly the correct description. It's exactly the system that we have, and you zeroed right in on it, Matt. So are you going to wear your T-shirt with pride?
Oh, with great pride.
Tremendous. Well, you know, it is a chick magnet.
I've been told.
All right, so be careful.
All right, I will try to.
Wear it wisely. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with military historian Crash Beckstead, who's telling us his fascinating stories of airplane crashes where he's been called in by the authorities to figure out where that plane came from and who was on it. Before the break, we were talking about the emergence of a plane from a glacier in Alaska.
And out of a 100,000-pound airplane, they brought back about 4,000 pounds of debris. And then I had the,
excuse me, I have to mention that leaves quite a few pounds out there, right?
That leaves an awful lot out there that's unaccounted for.
Right. Now, I guess it's just what, further up in the glacier, we think, or?
We don't know if it was pulverized to such an extent that it disintegrated, literally, molecularly. Uh-huh. I have a video of an F-4 that was launched into basically a house-sized block of concrete. And it was a test to see what happens to a high-performance aircraft hitting an immovable object like that.
Right.
And it actually came out as sort of a counter with some of the conspiracy theorists over the Pentagon and the World Trade Center on 9/11.
Oh, right.
And in this video, it shows this F-4 launching at about 500 miles an hour. It hits this block of concrete, and it literally just disintegrates. It becomes powder, and that's it. There's nothing left of it.
So there's just not much to recover. I mean, it's a gaseous state.
Yeah, it's molecular.
Wow.
And yes, there's still some of it that's still in the glacier. There's still some on the glacier that you couldn't see once. We cleaned up the surface of it, but anything below the surface, we're waiting until this summer. We'll fly back up and reassess it. But
right.
We've got this year's snowfall on top. And then depending upon how warm it gets, how quick it gets warm, will we have more exposed or not? And the glacier's still moving downhill.
Right.
While the JPAC team was out there, they had about a 200-meter wide section, about 40 meters deep, break off and fall into the lake. It scared the hell out of them.
Oh, I imagine it did, yeah. I mean, they're standing on that stuff.
Well, when you see pictures and videos and things of the glaciers, it's called calving
right.
When they break off like that. You see pictures of it on videos, and you go out the glacier cruises and things. It looks real impressive, but you have to realize you're probably 3 to 5 miles away from that when it's coming down. You're not standing on top of it a few hundred meters back from the face.
Right.
So, yeah, it got their attention really fast.
Well, anything particularly notable that they found? I mean, obviously the human remains were the most poignant part, but anything else that came out of the glacier that was particularly memorable?
One thing that was kind of fun, we found some dentures.
Really?
And actually we found quite a few dentures.
Huh.
And
these are military people. I was thinking they'd be mostly younger people.
That's the question. Can you have dentures and be on active duty? Well, not really. But that's where I come into play. I start digging in it. I get the passenger manifest. I start pulling things together. Oh, Dr. Singleton. What does he do? He's a dentist.
Oh, he was bringing them up there.
He was bringing them up.
He was like a bag of dentures. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Now,
he was
okay.
A dentist.
Okay, now I see.
And I also found another story of someone was relating it, that their father would tell them stories that when he was in the dental lab at Fort Rich, and they had a new lab that was opening either at McCord or Fort Lewis down in Washington, and he was going to fly down and do an inspection of it. Well, his boss, the lieutenant colonel, said, "Nah, I'll do it instead." So he flew down. That night, his father went out to the airfield waiting for that C-124 to come in, and he never came back because he was on the plane. So he died. So I've actually got two dentists on this airplane. So that explains the dentures.
That is interesting. Very interesting indeed.
We found a number of hockey pucks.
And that makes sense. They're bringing up some new pucks.
They're moving up. They're being transferred up.
Right.
They're bringing their personal gear with them.
Right.
There was actually one duffel bag that was found, still packed, intact, with the man's name on it.
Oh, man. And I bet his family was eager to get that.
Everything that could be attributed to a person on the aircraft was collected by JPAC, and anything subsequently that we found that was identifiable to a person,
right,
we sent to JPAC because that will be taken and given back to the families.
Right.
So in this case, it's the guy's whole kit.
Wow.
It was really interesting to see what survived intact, what didn't survive.
You know, that is interesting. My dad happened to be on active duty in the early 50s, roughly the time. I think you said this was 1952. And he had his old duffel bag from the time he was in the Army at that time. And, of course, as a kid, I was fascinated by it and always rummaged through it. And I learned a lot about my dad and about his military service just by rummaging through it. It's hard for me to imagine if my dad had been on that plane and getting it in the mail today. You know, that would be a very moving experience.
I'll bet it would be.
Wow. That is something. That is something. Okay. Anything else that came out of that particular crash?
None of that one, but I had another one I worked on a few years ago. It was a B-24 that crashed up.
A B-24 Liberator bomber from World War II?
World War II. Crashed on December 21st, 1943. It was up at Fairbanks at Ladd Field, and that was the cold weather testing center. They were trying to come up with a technique or a system that when they're flying up at altitude at 24,000 feet, everything gets cold. It's 50 below zero up there, and so your fluids are cold. They get stiff, they get thick, and when your engine died and you had to feather the propeller, there's a certain sequence you go through, and it turns the propeller so it's cutting through the wind rather than going flat against it. And that way you're not turning the engine and it's not dead weight on it and stuff. So they were trying to come up with a method of doing something to make it work better. That's the only way I can really describe it. They came up with a system where they would bleed avgas into the hydraulic fluid.
It's aviation
and
fuel.
Aviation gas.
Right.
So basically gasoline or kerosene into the hydraulic fluid, which would thin it out. So when they were up there at altitude, it wouldn't get as thick. And it's like taking, a thin vegetable oil and 80-weight gear lube. Mm-hmm. You know, you get vegetable oil cold enough, it's going to be just like that gear lube.
Right.
So by adding something thinner to it, it didn't get that thick.
Mm-hmm.
So they came up with a system, and they were testing it. And the crew was clear to go out and find some clear weather or clear areas and perform some tests. They were going to feather the props and stuff and see what was happening with them. They had a propeller specialist from Wright Field on there. He was an engineer. There was a five-man crew, him, co-pilot, pilot, radio operator, and the crew chief. And they went through their first cycle, and everything went fine. And they went through the second series of tests, and something went wrong. The number one engine, rather than feathering the prop, it went backwards, and it locked up flat.
Oh, so, man, that's just going to put the drag on that side of the
car. Imagine when you're in a car, and you put your hand out the window.
Yeah.
Like every kid does,
the
right?
The plane just started
spinning,
didn't
it? You go up and
it?
Down. No, it locked up. You put your hand flat. All of a sudden, you have all that extra flat surface causing drag.
Right, I was thinking that if you do that, then that's going to make the plane itself spin around a flat spin,
right,
isn't it? Okay,
right.
And
it went into a flat spin.
Oh, my gosh.
And so what do you do with a flat spin? You know, they train you. You've got to get the nose down so you get enough airflow going over your control surfaces to stabilize it. And then you pull out and you continue on. Well, they went down, they stopped the spinning, they're pulling back on this thing, nothing's happening. So they kept pulling back harder and harder, and the manual says pull back so far and it'll work. Nothing happened. They're still in this dive. So they pulled back even harder and heard a loud bang in the back of the airplane. And all of a sudden their rudder or their stabilizer control is gone. And they didn't know what's happening with it, and the plane started to come up. Well, at that point, it came up enough, it stalled, and fell off into another flat spin.
Oh, good heavens.
And they ended up using the ailerons to try to control that. In the meantime, they opened the bomb bay doors, which is their main means of egress. Plane spinning around.
Yeah, that's where you
flat.
Jump out with your parachute.
Right, that's where you go out
with your parachute.
If you
can get to it.
The pilot said hit the crash alarm as they're coming down, hit the crash alarm. The crew chief moved into radio operator's compartment and jumped as the co-pilot moved in right behind him. As he went out, he saw the pilot come into the radio operator's compartment. Now, this is all really tight space. You know, you'd have a hard time in there juggling parachutes plus all the winter gear and everything else.
Right.
They didn't know if the two guys in the back of the plane had even gotten out yet. And plane's coming down, co-pilot gets out, his chute pops open, plane slams on the ground almost immediately. He was probably less than 500 feet above the ground when he got out. Before I jump there, he survived the crash. He parachutes out, he landed about 200 meters away from the aircraft when it hit and exploded.
And that's how we know all this stuff.
That and putting all the pieces back together.
Okay,
again.
I was going to ask you how you knew all this. Like somebody had to survive. I mean, or this had to be the best crash reconstruction in history. But go on,
well,
please.
He survived.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And in this special Memorial Day episode, we're talking to military historian Crash Beckstead about some of the airplane crashes that he's investigated for the United States Air Force. After the break, we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll finish our discussion with Crash Beckstead. Stick around.
So, Kelly, what's going on at Montpelier this week? Or maybe not just this week, but over the next few weeks?
Yeah, well, we are gearing up for our summer institutes for teachers and the general public.
That sounds very impressive.
Yeah.
Summer Institute. What is a summer institute at Montpelier?
Well, we bring teachers and folks to Montpelier to come live in our Constitutional Village and study the Constitution. We've got three different seminars, a couple that are specifically targeted for teachers. One, the We the People program.
Right.
We have a program at the end of June, June 29th through the July 2nd, coming up. Another one that is open.
Well, before we leave that one, though, We the People, of course, is that wonderful high school and middle school competition involving this. It can be a class, it can be a club, whatever. People can compete or not compete, but what you're trying to do there is what, to train teachers or to encourage teachers to become sponsors of We the People?
And to encourage them to become sponsors, but, you know, it's more than just that. They get in full classroom textbook. They, you know, learn different strategies of teaching civics and government in their class. We have a great scholar who comes and teaches in the morning, and then we do the simulation in the afternoon, and it's just always a very fun learning environment. So school gets out, comes. Stay with us for 3 or 4 days.
Oh, that's an absolutely wonderful opportunity. I want people to come. And in fact, I know there are other summer institutes coming up, but we're about out of time for this week. So why don't we talk about the other ones on another this week?
Sure. And you know, you can check all of them out, learn.montpelier.org or montpelier.org, and check out our courses and sign up.
Tremendous. Thank you.
Thank you.
During World War II, the United States produced only 3 4-engined long-range bombers in any numbers. These were the B-29 Superfortress, the B-17 Flying Fortress, and the B-24 Liberator. The B-29 entered active service only in 1944, but played a large part in the reduction of Japan's wartime capacity, razing its cities and destroying its factories before delivering the final blows of the war in the atom bomb attacks. The B-17, the legendary Flying Fortress, was one of the war's most famous aircraft and a mainstay of the strategic bombing campaign against Germany. The Liberator was the other important American bomber of that campaign. But the B-24 has been overshadowed somewhat by its two illustrious contemporaries. In fact, it was produced in far larger numbers than either of them. A later design than the Fortress, its production began after the war had begun and halted before its end. Yet, in that time, over 18,000 of them were made. They saw service in every theatre of the conflict, in a variety of roles, and proved, despite their ugly duckling reputation, to be one of the most effective weapons of the war. Before the B-24s came on the scene, there was a 300-mile gap in the middle of the ocean where the existing planes were unable to supply air cover for the slow, inadequately escorted convoys. In this gap, the U-boats, hunting in wolf packs, were able to regularly engage in massacres of the assembled targets. Relatively unendangered and operating often on the surface, where they were faster than many of the corvettes and destroyers supposedly hunting them. Both the Army and the Navy used the Liberators in many more roles than had been originally contemplated. In addition to bombing raids, transport duties and anti-submarine patrols, they saw service as reconnaissance planes, tankers, search and rescue aircraft and personnel carriers. As the war had gone on, the B-24s had continued evolving through a succession of models, with the loads carried soaring at times to improbable levels. Often the Liberators were loaded to the point of being difficult to handle, but still the big planes coped.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking with military historian Crash Beckstead about a B-24 Liberator bomber that crashed high on an Alaskan mountaintop all the way back in 1943. There was only one survivor.
He then goes, works, he stays at the crash site for a week, 7 days. All he has with him is a parachute, an experimental down-filled jacket with thin, real thin nylon on the outside. Oh, his gloves, they're on the instrument panel of the airplane.
Oh, man.
His hat, it's somewhere in the airplane. Gee, he has two boxes of matches that he picked up because he knew the pilot liked to smoke a pipe. So he wasn't actually on the crew, so he was being nice to the pilot. They'd invited him to come along and fly because he wanted to get some time in a multi-engine plane. He flew fighters. And so just a sheer fluke with him. So here he is in the middle of nowhere, 120 miles east of Fairbanks, on a mountain. All you can see is snow and ice around you and mountains. He was from Philadelphia. He was a Center City kid. He had been on one winter camping trip to Valley Forge as a Boy Scout. Oh, and he had his Boy Scout pocket knife. And he had a letter that his father had written him. And that was all he had. And here he is sitting there, waist deep in the snow. What do I do? He read the letter again and used it to start a fire, gathered some wood stuff, and used that letter to start a fire, and stayed there for a week, and wrapped up in his parachute for a little warmth that he could get at night. And usually, you know, they train you. You go down in a plane crash, stay with the airplane. It's easier to spot the airplane than it is to spot you out there somewhere.
Right.
So he's following his training. Nobody shows up. So he finally says, well, okay, in Boy Scouts, they train you. Always go to the water source and follow the stream downhill or downstream. It will eventually get to a bigger stream and a river. There's going to be a town somewhere. So he goes downhill, finds the river, Charlie River, falls through the ice.
Oh, man.
Gets out and gets himself dried off and spends a couple days there, works his way down a little bit farther, and comes across that he described as the strangest sight he'd ever seen. It was a little log cabin up on stilts. We call it a cache. That's where you put your food and stuff in to keep it away from the animals.
Right.
And so here's this little log cabin up on stilts. And he went over and looked at it, climbed up in it, and there's a sleeping bag, a couple of bear skins, there's food, all sorts of things.
Oh, man, it's Christmas time.
Yeah, and then he got looking around the area, and there, he he found the cabin that was associated with it.
Right.
It had about a 4-foot-high door in it, so I had to climb down under it. Here's the wood stove. It's all taken apart, so we figured out how to put it back together again. There's dry wood. There's shavings. It's ready to go. He builds a fire, gets the frying pan out, makes up a frying pan full of hot chocolate. Saved his life, at least at that point. Over the next about 75 days, he works his way down the Charlie River. It's about 110 miles. He kind of explores back and forth because he doesn't know anything about the area.
In the cabin, I bet he was reluctant to leave that cabin.
Yeah.
I mean, I can understand you'd want to get back to civilization, but on the other hand, you're thinking, how long is the food going to last up here?
That, and also, how much can I take with me?
Yeah, how much can I take with me? Boy, that would have been a conflict.
And so he built a sled out of a wash tub and a couple of old skis, and just the ingenuity of Lieutenant Crane is just amazing. And, you know, he's got this drive to survive. So 83 days later, or about 75 days later, he shows up at the mouth of the Charlie River, down near the mouth, joins into the Yukon River, and he noticed this big clearing, and there were little spruce trees spaced apart in this long line, and he realized it was a landing strip. So he got out there and he's running down this landing strip and he finds a cabin at the other end. And there's a checkered tablecloth out on the line outside this cabin. And there's smoke coming out of the chimney. So he yelled to the folks in the cabin, and the old trapper that was there came out, and both of them were just as shocked to find each other there. Because Al Ames had spent, you know, years and years out there with he and his wife and their two little kids. And so now he's actually saved, because he's got somebody else there that knows the territory that can help him out to get him back. So he spent 3 days there with Al and his family, and I've actually spoken with both of Al's kids about it. And they took a photograph of him standing next to the cabin and one standing with his daughter. They used a dog sled, snowshoes, and took him two drainages over to a mining camp over there. Now, let me back up real quick for something. In this cabin, he found a stack of magazines. That was the old Alaska Sportsman magazine. It's now Alaska Magazine. And they were addressed to a man by the name of Phil Burrell. It said, Woodchopper, Alaska. And Lieutenant Crane noted that, and he said, what a place where you can have your name and your occupation and the territory, and your mail will get to you.
That was the address.
Yeah, that was the address.
Al Burrell, Woodchopper, Alaska.
Yeah. So, Al Ames takes him over two creeks over to this mining operation, and who does he meet there but the winter caretaker? His name is Phil Burrell. They're on Woodchopper Creek. So that's how he got his mail.
I see.
Because he wasn't a woodchopper, but he was
Woodchopper
at Woodchopper Creek.
Now I see.
So that's how the address comes about. So he tells Mr. Burrell about what had happened and everything, and he says, wow, I left that cabin about 3 years ago. I'm glad somebody was able to use that stuff. They called in the mail plane, and Bush Pilot came in and picked up Lieutenant Crane, flew him back to Fairbanks. And they're coming into Ladd Field, and they radioed into the tower and said, like permission to land at your field. And they radioed back, said, no, field's closed, go on to Fairbanks. Mr. Rice radioed back in and said, I've got Lieutenant Leon Crane with me. And they're like, wait a minute. There's a long pause on the radio. And they came back and said, is he alive or dead? He'd been gone for 83 days at this point.
Almost 3 months.
No evidence of what happened, where they were, or anything else. And the two of them in the airplane had a good laugh over it. And he radioed back and said, he's very much alive. So they said, okay, land on the field, taxi right to the control tower. You'll be met by a staff car. The commander of the base came out and met them as he got out of the airplane. Took him over to his office and said, before we do anything, you've already been cleared for the phone call. Call your parents. So Leon called home. Dad answered the phone, and he said, well, Dad, I had a little trouble on this last flight. I had to walk back.
But thanks for the letter.
But it's a great story on that part.
Right.
However, there were five people on the plane.
Yeah.
Okay. They found two Leon Crane actually took them back to the crash site the next day. they flew back into it and found the airplane and everything. They found two bodies in the back of the plane, the propeller specialist and the radio operator. So now we've got three bodies accounted for. We know the crew chief got out of the airplane because he went out before Crane did. And all Crane saw, remembered seeing, was he went over, his parachute went over the next ridge. And different versions of the story, it's anywhere from a short distance to 10 miles away. That leaves the pilot. What happened to him? And I talked to some men who had been on the search and rescue team who went back to the site and recovered the bodies and everything, and they said, we didn't find any evidence of a third man there, so we assume he got out of the plane. Well, I was up there 1 year, and I was just digging through I was trying to document the crash site very, very thoroughly, and I took like 500 pictures that day of it, because I wanted to get everything covered. I didn't know when I'd be back, if I'd be back. And I was in an area where the ground was a little discolored, and I was just digging through it with my fingers a little bit, and I saw some unusual buckles. And it was a two-piece buckle. They go together at a 90-degree angle, and then they twist and lock together. And I had a sneaky suspicion what they might be, but I wasn't certain. So I'm digging through this dirt, and this little voice in the back of my head says, just keep digging. So, okay. And I thought, wait, where am I at? So I pulled out my schematics of the airplane. I'm in the radio operator's compartment. I'm in exactly the last place that the pilot was seen.
Now, I have to back you up a little bit. When you're at the crash site, what time of year is this?
This was in August.
Okay, so it's summertime.
So it's summertime. No snow on the ground.
Okay.
Beautiful day.
Now, how much of the plane is left? And what year was this, incidentally?
This was 2004.
Okay, so and this had crashed in 1943. 43. So it was 61 years later.
Right.
Now, was there anything left of the B-24?
Oh, yeah. The whole airplane's there.
Oh, it really is?
It looks like... I'll show you some pictures of it afterwards. Mm-hmm. It looks like a beer can that someone stepped on. Mm-hmm. When you see it from above, because it was in a flat spin, it hit twisted. And came straight
right.
down, and it just went bam into the rocks. The one wing tip caught because it's on a slight slope, and so one wing is broken. And the fuselage is kinked slightly because it was slightly nose down.
Right.
But you look at it and you say, that's a B-24.
You can still identify
the profile. The profile.
But on the ground level, can you tell what it is?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so you are like in the wreckage.
I am in the wreckage. I'm in the airplane. I've got
okay, so you're in where the radio operator was, the last place this guy was seen.
And I'm digging through this dirt and I thought, could this be Lieutenant Hoskins' ashes? And I'm starting a little weirded out at this point.
Right.
Because the forward part of the plane, where all the fuel is, burned. And it burned very efficiently. All the aluminum is gone there. And according to Lieutenant Crane, it burned for about a day and a half because of the full load of fuel that it had on it. Out there in an Arctic environment, in the cold, it's going to burn slower, but just as hot. So anyway, I'm digging through this stuff, and I find these buckles, and this little voice in the back of my head says, keep digging. I'm like, okay. So I just kept digging a little bit. And then I found another small buckle. It was like a hook and eye loop fastener, like ladies have on the back of a collar on a dress.
Right.
But it was about a half an inch big. So it was much bigger than I'd seen before. And the little voice changed. It said, stop. So I stopped. I'm like, okay. This voice is getting serious now.
Right.
I collected up about a tablespoon or two of the material from right there, put it into a Ziploc bag I had, and brought it back to Fairbanks. And I'd already been in touch with a funeral home there. And I had questions about cremation and stuff because if he was still in the plane, I wanted to know what might be there. And I called the guy back up. He said, bring it over, let's look. Took it over, showed it to him, and he goes, you may have something here. Uh-huh. So then I brought JPAC, same folks
from
Hawaii.
Guys from Hickam Airport.
I brought them back into it, sent the stuff off to them. And they analyzed it, and they said they didn't see any bone material in it, but they wanted to come take a closer look. It took 2 years to get on their radar screen because they are so busy and have so few people, and it's so expensive with the operations they do.
Mm-hmm.
2 years later, they came back up, picked me up at the mining camp that we used, flew me out to the site on a Black Hawk, had their entire team that would be going out there to do an excavation because they had to cover their communications, security, logistics, and then the archaeologist who would be overseeing the actual excavation work. That was in June. Went back in the end of August, and we started excavating the site. And the second day of digging, we found the upper part of the radius bone of the pilot.
Wow.
And that happened to be the same day that my granddaughter was born. So it's
significant
kind of,
day for you in a couple of respects. And of course, we have to say again that this was a real fellow with a real family, and I'm sure that if they're listening, this is very poignant for them to hear. And it's always poignant to think of the serviceman who died in service to his country. But as a historical matter, that must have been quite a fascinating and intriguing discovery for you.
And I didn't even work with the Air Force at that point. I was still with the Park Service.
Right.
But it was just the whole thing about, we found this guy who's been missing for 63 years, and we're going to get him home. You know, the excitement was just amazing.
Right. So it wasn't just a matter of historical revelation. You really were excited about getting him back to his family.
I was ecstatic about it.
Okay, well, that's great.
Because the first trip I'd made up there in 1994, I remember walking up to the crash site thinking, who was on the plane? What happened to them? I knew nothing about the story at that point. So we excavated the site. We recovered a fair amount of remains. JPAC took them back to Hawaii. They did all their identification stuff and all. 6 months later, I got a phone call from his brother in Maine. And he said, well, they've come and they've identified. They've said they've got Harold's remains, and he's coming home. And I said, that's fantastic. John, can I ask when and where's the funeral going to be? What are the plans? And he said, we've decided we're going to have the funeral at Arlington. And he said, I would like you to come to the funeral. And I said, John, I planned on it. But I would just be standing in the back. I said, this is your time. I got it to here. I just want to see it come to a close. He said, oh, no, Doug. We want you to come as part of the family. And so I flew down here. The funeral was exactly 1 year from the day we came off the mountain.
Listeners cannot see you now, Crash, but there are tears in your eyes as you tell the story. And I must admit, I'm getting a little misty over here myself. That's just very inspirational. And I have to say congratulations to you. And that was well done.
That was the highlight of my life, is doing that.
I believe it.
And to be back there with his son, his brother. Mm-hmm. He actually had a daughter as well. And she was born, I think it was 6 months after he crashed.
Oh,
and
so never
she
met
never
him.
Knew her father. But she knew him through her mother. She never got remarried. She came to the funeral, had a bunch of letters and things, photographs of them. And it was really exciting going through those. After the funeral, his daughter came over to me. We were sitting in a hotel room just talking about Lieutenant Hoskin and stories of the family and things. And his daughter walked over to me, and she held her hand out to me as though she had something for me. And so I put my hand out, and she dropped a set of his wings in my hand.
Oh, how nice.
And she said, those were my father's. I think he would like you to have them.
Wow. What a story, and what an appropriate time of year to hear such a story about the brave men and women in our military and the dangers that they face to protect our constitutional way of life. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.